Father, thank you for the gift of community, the gift of relationships, even hearing men and women talk, enjoy one another, laughing, connecting. There really is a gift from you. The book of James says that every good gift comes from above, from the Father of lights. And we don't take these relationships for granted. We don't take the joy that you give us for granted in our connection to others. And so we thank you for that. Right now, Lord, I ask that you would speak through me and in spite of me this morning as we look at a topic that really has a real effect, actually, in our connections with each other. And so, Lord, I just pray you'd use it to bless, to encourage, to challenge, and to help us just see you clear, Jesus, and the good life you invite us into. In your name we pray. Amen. So today we're going to be continuing our Life-Changing Convos series. And if you're new, by the way, Life-Changing Convos can sound a little arrogant, like you're talking to this microphone is going to change my life. No, not necessarily. The Life-Changing Convos refers to the conversations that Jesus had in the Gospels. We're studying those conversations. So we believe that the things that he said really could change anyone's life. And so we're going to look at interactions with Jesus and different types of people. And today we're going to look at a story of a man who'd failed a lot and had a lot of regret, and simultaneously was pretty jealous of other people. And jealousy isn't like the coolest topic. It's not it's not something that is easy to admit you struggle with. There are other things like, oh, I like to eat too much, or maybe I have one too many beers, whatever. But to say, I'm really jealous of people, feels a little gross, if we're honest. We don't like to say it out loud. To say it to someone else, to say it to someone you're actually jealous of is feels real gross. And so but this is just true to human experience. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. So if you have Bibles, we're going to be in John chapter 21. And specifically, I'm going to look at this idea of comparison. I remember comparison really popping to me a few years back. My oldest son, Clive, he's super athletic, to be honest. And he joined a track and field club when he was in like third grade. And he was a really fast kid. And so I was excited about that. And that's not news. The fact that he's fast. My wife's brother was a starting running back on a team that went to the CIF championship game. His grandfather played football at Lincoln High School, started on offense with the Marcus Allen. She has a cousin who played Division I football at Auburn. And on top of that, I'm his dad. So you know, like, this guy's got horsepower. You look at me, you know I'm an athlete, okay? Why are you guys laughing? So you just have those kids insanely athletic. In all seriousness, Clive is fast. He really is fast. And so I was excited to go, you know, watch him go out there and just smoke these little fourth graders, you know? I get there and I'm watching him. And he is. When they have, like, 10 kids running, he's winning every race. And then there's a kid who started to beat him, but only when they were one-on-one. And he was beating the same kid when there was 10 of them. So it was confusing to me. And as I watched him, what I realized was the reason why Clive was slowing down. He was faster than this kid. He did smoke this fool. But what made it harder to smoke him was that he would look over. And it's hard to run fast. You know, I'm no track coach. I am an athlete, but I'm no track coach. I'm no running form expert. But typically, you want to be right here, eyes forward, moving. He's looking over, and that's how it's happening. So basically, trying to keep up with whatever's happening over here is slowing him down from running the race that he needed to run. And so we talked about it, and then next race, smoked him. So now that being said, if we're honest, that story, it might seem simple. It's a kid's story. It's about running a race. But if we're honest about the way many of us live our lives, especially in a time where social media is just everywhere and comparison traps are everywhere, we often use others to figure out how we're doing in life as a reference point. We often, even as people who claim to be Christians, we go, how are they doing? And then I determine where I'm at. And there's a dark side to this that we're going to get into. But today I really want to talk about just two ideas. One is calling, what you're called to. And the other thing is how does comparison get in the way of that? And so I have two questions I'm going to look at this morning. One is, what is calling comparison? And then two, how can we be set free from comparison to step into our unique callings or vocations? One author described comparison this way. He said, comparison is determining who I am based on what other people are. So I'm gonna use that definition and add to it a little bit. And for the purposes of calling comparison, I'm going to say that calling comparison is determining what I am or am not called to based on what other people are called to. And this is easy for us to fall into. There was a man, pretty famous French philosopher named René Girard. If you've studied philosophy, you've probably read. If you studied philosophy in the last 20 years in college, you probably read of him. And he, his branch of philosophy was called anthropological philosophy, and it's philosophy that takes a huge stab at the question of what are humans here for, what do we need, what do we do. And he noticed this pattern of comparison, and he gave it a name, and the name was mimetic desire. Mimetic desire. Girard argued that we don't usually desire things independently. We learn what to want by watching others. In other words, our wants are contagious. So for example, imagine a little boy sitting on the floor and he's playing with a toy and he's not doing anything that would make the average observer of him playing with this toy think this toy is a funner toy than all the other toys that are in this room right now. He's not going, man, this is the best toy I've ever played with. He's not making any declarations. He's just a kid kind of kicking it, playing with a toy. But what Girard says is 9 times out of 10, another little boy, when he walks into that room, he will scan the floor. He will see dozens of toys scattered around, and his eyes will lock on the one thing that's already in use, that truck. Suddenly, that's the toy he wants. Not the robot, not the fire engine, not the Tickle Me Elmo, not the box is dated right there, not the box of Legos, just the truck. He doesn't want it because it's the best toy in the room. He wants it because someone else has it first. This is why there are different standards of beauty in different parts of the world, because we want what other people want. This is why I look back on my high school years. I grew up in South San Diego, West Chula Vista, and I saw a bunch of cholos in our yearbook with puka shells on, which cholos don't normally rock. But people were wearing them, so people were like, you know what, I'm going to wear those too, right? Like, you look back on some of your fashion choices, right? I mean, you guys have the emo slash, right? You look back, you're like, man, what was happening, right? I know a guy. I'm not going to name names. You're not going to believe a guy that had a haircut like that. Who's a real shaved head bad boy now? If you know, you know. It's not me. It wasn't me. It was not me. I was an athlete. I was an emo kid. We've been through this. But we mimic the so again, and this is how advertising works, right? Like that's why product placement with athletes or supermodel, you see someone that you want to be like, and they have that thing, and you go, I want that thing, even though they're paid to pretend they have the thing, or they were given the thing just to convince you. You even know that at a cognitive level, and you go, oh, I gotta have that. Right? And so I would say Ariana Grande is wrong. It's not I want it, I got it. It's they got it, I want it. And so, and this is the dynamic of what's described in the book of James. In James chapter 4, the apostle James, Jesus' brother, he says, what is the source of wars and fights among you? Don't they come from your passions that wage war within you? You desire and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and wage war. This is true when kids behave badly. It's true when nations go to war. And it's true when a marital conflict is spiraling out of control. I want it. I want it. I want it because they have it. We covet and covet and covet. And we can do the same thing with the purpose of our life, with calling, with talents, with gifts. And here's the thing, we can fixate on the truck and we can become obsessed. The truck's a metaphor, for the record. Some of you guys, you do want a truck, too bad though, because you have a coworker who's got a truck, a big boy truck. But we can fixate on the toy and go, if I just had that, right? But here's the reality. God doesn't do copy and paste callings. He's not handing out like the same thing. We're all called to love God and love people and love him with all our heart, mind, soul, strength, and self. But where we do that, when we do that, how we do that's going to be unique. It's as unique as your fingerprints, the way that you get to image God in the world, which if you think about it, it's actually kind of exciting. It means you have inherent worth and dignity and purpose. You were designed for a life of impact. But here's the problem. If we're busy trying to take away someone else's toy, we're not taking hold of the calling that's actually ours. So all the time you spend pretending to be someone else or obsessing about what they are, you're not being you. And God made you good. He made you lovely, as some would say. Again, we can do this with money, we can do this with talent, we could do this with physical attractiveness, we could do this, you know, on and on and on. So I know Cloud's not alone in comparison. We often look over in this race of life. And again, all throughout our lives, there's different ways to compare ourselves to each other. It's pretty trendy when your kid graduates college, you post their acceptance letters all over your social media. I see that all the time. Engagements. I mentioned this before, but engagements. What used to be romantic about a proposal in marriage was that someone wanted to spend the rest of their life with you until they died through thick and thin. Now it's like, how did you ask? Where'd you do it? How romantic did it get? Right? I remember Jeremy Zimmer, he's the tech guy in the back, but he was he can fly helicopters, which is a fun thing to be able to do. And our friend James got engaged, and he took them on like a helicopter ride as part of the proposal. And I told my dad that story. My dad's like, I would just give up if I was a man today. Like, I don't even know. Like a helicopter ride? Good night, nurse. And then weddings, right? Again, the thing about weddings that's amazing is just covenantal love. There's this commitment. There's this, I'm going to be with you forever. Like, let's work at this thing. Let's build a family and a future together. And now it's like, how good was the fish, though? How nice were the dresses? How nice was the beard trim on the groomsmen? How nice were the shoes on? You know, you can go on and on and on. My favorite one, I like to come at often, birthing plans. We're competitive about birthing plans. You know, if you were to ask your grandma, what was your friend's birthing plans? She would say, what's a birthing plan? Right? Like, oh, you're gonna use drugs, you're gonna get epidural. You hate your baby, right? Or oh, you're gonna just put yourself through. You don't know. It's like, why do I even know this about you? Why do I know what you're gonna do with these things? This is weird, right? You getting circumcised, you're not getting circumcised? Like, dude, get out of here. Then the baby's born, and then we get into like whose baby is the best behaved as a baby. How much do they cry, right? Man, my baby, great sleeper, right? Better than your baby who can never sleep. And I know you can't sleep because I see your face all the time, you know? People aren't that mean, but that's how it feels, you know? How quickly you get back into shape after the baby is born, right? You're just hitting the YMCA again. You're getting on the treadmill. Your kid's in child watch for the first time. And then you got like jump squat Jackie showing off, you know, only 8 weeks, you know, post-baby. Hashtag postpartum fitness goals. You get it going on and on and on, all the way into grandparents' retirement, on and on and on. And so our life can be one big look over, look here, look over, look here. Or we can look up and then walk into our entire life to be present for things like engagements and weddings and the birth of your kids and the family that you live into and the community you give yourself to, and on it goes. Comparison is super dangerous spiritually. I'd put it in the category of busyness. I'm sure you guys have heard about this before or talked about it before. You might have read John Mark Comer's The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. Hurriness, it's not a sin to be hurried or busy, but the idea is it's subtle because it impacts everything else. You don't realize the side effect of if you're always busy, you can never have important conversations with the people closest to you. If you're always busy, you don't really have time to pray. I think comparison's similar because comparison can just feel like, I'm just noticing that they have better stuff than me, right? I'm just noticing their spouse seems a lot nicer to them than mine. That would never happen with us, but I'm just saying people do that, right? And again, even saying it, it's weird because that happens in some of your, it happens in hearts. That's why it talks about in the Bible, coveting. Right? I'm just noticing their house. I'm just noticing the job that they have. I'm just noticing the support they have and whatever, you know, it is. And the reason it's dangerous is because it leads a place really quickly. It leads to a place of animosity and jealousy and envy. I mentioned this recently. I just completed a counseling program. And one of the things we recently talked about were how people interpret their stories in different ways to feel okay about themselves. As they look back on, you know, times of shame or guilt or whatever. And the way that we look back on them aren't healthy is kind of the idea. So some people, they look back on their stories with denial. So, man, I had a perfect life, perfect upbringing, you know, like brutally physically abusive parents, but we had a great family, right? And he says, but other people, their narrative is one of envy. And he said, this often feels like the darkest narrative. Because he says, envy is a step further than jealousy. Envy says, I hate you for having what you have, and I want you to feel bad that you have it. One of the guys that was in our cohort, he talked about how when he was in high school, he experienced the death of several family members, and he met up with a guy that he went to high school with like 30 years later. And he said, I was talking to this guy, and I said, man, high school was a really painful time for me. Like, I had a lot of deaths. I had a lot of, was grieving. It's kind of unique for like a junior in high school. And he said, the only thing that I look back on in high school that felt good was like, we'd go on ski trips twice a year. We had the like ski thing at school or whatever. Obviously, it wasn't in California. I guess it could be. I didn't grow up at a school that had ski trips. He's sharing this with this guy he hasn't seen in like 30 years. The guy goes, yeah, I could never go on ski trip because our family was poor. So your trips were actually painful to me. He's like, oh. So he replied, cool, right? There's this idea of, man, even the thing that brought you comforts, I'm going to tear it down because I didn't have it. And so again, comparison and jealousy can feel like subtle sins at first. We're just looking around. We're just kind of window shopping. We're just kind of thinking. But as time goes on, it can move us away from Jesus into a place that's pretty dark, where we judge others in some brutal ways that we would never say out loud, but affects our relationships. You can't be super jealous of someone and love them well. And so we've got to be able to talk about these things. And I'm not talking about godly comparison. Comparison is not inherently bad. Paul writes in the New Testament, follow me as I follow Christ, right? And so what I want to ask again is so who or what is going to define your calling if not comparison? How would you know what you're called to do if you weren't just looking at others? Which leads to our text today, and I only have 6 verses. It's not going to be a long message from here on, but I really want you to sit with this. So we're going to be in John chapter 21. We'll be in verse 15. You need to know the chapter right before this in John 20. It tells of Jesus' resurrection, kind of an Easter story, big deal. And then in John 21, the disciples are depressed, discouraged. They don't know he has been raised from the dead. And they're led by Peter, and they go back to the life they used to live, which is often what we do when we're disappointed in faith. When we're disappointed in God, we often think, I might just go back to how it used to be before I followed Jesus. And so Peter, he was carrying this heavy burden of failure. He had a lot of failure in his story, and we'd find out that that's not final, but he failed a lot. All throughout the Gospels, if you want to feel good about yourself spiritually, if you claim to be a follower of Jesus, just look at Peter's life and go, I wouldn't do that, right? And Jesus didn't give up on him. Peter got into an actual argument with the other disciples about who was the greatest out loud in front of Jesus. Again, one thing to judge someone and go, I think I'm better than them. It's another thing to go, I think I'm better than you. Like raging narcissists are too smart for that, right? Peter then tries to talk Jesus out of going to the cross, to which he says, get behind me, Satan, because that's what Satan would want him to do. He almost ruined salvation for all of us. Cool, Peter. Peter resists Jesus' attempts to wash his feet. Jesus reminds him, unless he can wash him, referring to the cleansing of his blood on the cross, Peter will no longer be able to be in his presence. Peter, one time, he gets really mad at, they go to a town to kind of to preach and share a little missions trip, and no one offers him a sandwich, and he wants to call down fire from heaven to kill everyone. Jesus goes, that's not how we use our power. Then at the end, towards the end of life, it's the Last Supper. Peter makes this thug life, kind of blood in, blood out vow. I'll always have your back, Jesus. No matter who leaves you, I'll never leave you. I'll always have your back. And Jesus is like, no, you aren't. When the rooster crows, you'll have denied me not once, not twice, but 3 times. I went on a trip to Israel a few years ago. We were in East Jerusalem, and we're at the location where it's traditionally believed that it's the house of Caiaphas, the high priest. And it's the site of Peter's last denial of Jesus, the night Jesus was being prepared for crucifixion. And the church has a steeple, and at the top of the steeple is not a cross, there's a rooster, reminding us of the failure of Peter. Because Peter fails to stand by Jesus' side and pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. He falls asleep. I feel betrayed by my wife when she falls asleep when we're trying to watch a movie for the 4th time because she keeps falling asleep. Can you imagine the lowest point in your life and they can't stay awake and pray? And sure enough, when Jesus is arrested, Peter's asked about him and he punks out. He denies that he knows Jesus. He denies Jesus to his face. Again, I've often wondered if I was in a country where Christianity was illegal and facing prison or torture or death, would I recant my faith in Jesus if I was put in that position like martyrs throughout church history? And I wondered what the Holy Spirit would give me Would he give me what I needed in that moment to stand? How would I do? We know how Peter does. He fails. He collapses. So Peter is completely, and it wouldn't, it's understandable, but it's like, dude, why make the vow? Like, no matter what, bro. And so Peter's completely overwhelmed by his sin, self-discovery of his own weakness. He kind of quits the apostolic team. He goes back to the only work he feels he can do, fishing. But at the beginning of John 21, in what must have seemed like a ghost, Jesus appears to the disciples while they're fishing. And when Peter realizes it's the Lord, he jumps out of the boat. He swims to the shore. Many have seen this as a sign of Peter's devotion, but I don't think that's necessarily what's happening. I think Peter's desperate to apologize to Jesus to make things right, right? I don't know if you've ever had a moment in your life where you know you wronged someone, like you know you're in the wrong relationally, and it's been a minute since you've seen them, and then there's the thought about seeing them again, and you feel, right, you feel it in your stomach, you feel it in your, right? There's that. He's like, oh man, the guy that I denied and it led to his murder, he's raised from the dead, right? Not a great feeling probably. And so we'll pick up here after he has swam into shore. John 21, verse 15, it says, when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Yes, Lord, he said to him. You know that I love you. Feed my lambs, he told him. A second time he asked him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Yes, Lord, he said to him. You know that I love you. Shepherd my sheep, he told him. He then asked him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved that he had asked the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Feed my sheep, Jesus said. This is a fascinating passage for a lot of reasons. One of them was actually pointed out in my counseling program, but one of them is Jesus seems to understand how a corrective experience works because Peter denied Jesus by a fire, by charcoal. And so he's smelling a fire. We also know that he denied Jesus three times, and now he's asking him three times, do you love me? Which is fascinating. We also know that the first time Jesus ever revealed himself to Peter was on a night where they were fishing, and he just started talking out at them, and he's doing that again in the same place. And so it's like he's undoing that shame and guilt that feels so real, feels so tangible, feels so close. And he's undoing the guilt and the shame. As we see, he's even giving him something back. Again, imagine something you feel guilt or shame about from your story. Then imagine something that you really regret doing, and then imagine Jesus telling you, essentially, I've taken care of that. We are good to begin again. You don't have to hang your head anymore. You have to keep apologizing. You do love me. Now go and do the work I've called you to do. So he denies Jesus three times. He punks out. He assumes, I'm disqualified to lead. And Jesus says, I want you to lead again. Now go. It wasn't like a long process. And so, again, the visceral reality of making eye contact with Jesus while he denied him, while he was being taken away to be tortured. The cringe, the regret. And now you're looking him in the eyes again as he restores you. You would think that at this point, Peter would be most focused on Jesus and Jesus alone for the rest of his life, right? This is the ultimate camp high, right? There's like come to Jesus moments, and there's a literal come to Jesus moment. And it's good, and there's grace, and there's freedom. And you just imagine, okay, he's going to ride this. This is a heck of a camp high. He's going to ride this home. But as we'll see, that doesn't happen in quite the way that you might assume. Verse 18, he says, truly I tell you, when you were younger, you would tie your belts and walk wherever you wanted. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will tie you and carry you where you don't want to go. In other words, Peter, you're going to die by crucifixion too, which church history tells us he did. Verse 19, he said this to indicate by what kind of death Peter would glorify God with. After saying this, he told him, follow me. Now, again, you would think after this come to Jesus moment, it would be like, yes, send me anywhere. Lord, send me anywhere. I am down. I will do anything you want. I've got this new lease on life. I've got a renewed purpose. I thought the thing I bought into was a hoax, but he's back to life. I thought I failed. If it was true, I've failed too much. And he's given everything back and then some in an instant by the king of the universe in a face-to-face conversation over some like breakfast fish tacos. Jesus even cooks for him. And then, and so you think he'd be psyched, but Peter says this, verse 20, when he said, follow me, instead of saying, yes, Lord, it says, so Peter turned around and saw the disciple Jesus loved following them, the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and asked, Lord, who is the one who's going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about him? What about him? Jesus has given everything back in an instant. And he pulls out his kind of ancient Hebrew social media tablet and goes, what about that guy, though? What's his calling? And then Jesus says, if I want him to remain until I come, Jesus answered, what is that to you? As for you, follow me. It's been said that comparison is a joy thief, and it really is. And again, the thing I want you to hit all the time. Here's what's crazy about Peter. Like, think about this for a second. Peter had a fairly significant impact on the history of the church. Would you guys agree? Right? Like, every story about if you die, it's St. Peter's gates. That's not even in the Bible, but man, people think it is because that's how big of an impact he had. He wrote two books of the Bible. Most people think that Mark's gospel is his story. So he's got three books of the Bible that he essentially sources. He is, Catholics believe he was the first bishop of Rome, the first pope, basically. I mean, this guy is known for a lot of things. Jesus said, on my rock, I'll build this church. And again, I think that's talking about his confession of faith, but either way, it's him that had it in that moment. He's a big deal. It's not that the Apostle John isn't a big deal. It's just that he had his own calling. So think about all the stuff he would have missed out on if he just looked at that. And this is true for us too. All this time we spend trying to live someone else's life instead of the one God has given us, we can't do the things that only we can do. And so I'll close with just a few practical things. How can we be set free from comparison to step into our callings? The first one is to find our identity in Jesus. Do you really believe that you are loved and known by the King of the universe? Yesterday, I spoke at a conference in Orange County, and my kids came and stuff. And Tabitha and Felipe came, and they got to share their testimonies. And as they shared their testimonies, I talked to so many people about the idea of being known and loved at the same time was a big part of their stories. Because you can be known, but go, you know me, but you don't really know me. You love me, but it's because you don't know me. Does that make sense? And if you knew me, you wouldn't love me. And in the gospel, we are fully known and fully loved at the same time, which means fully known, fully understood. You know how many of us are desperate to be known? We like beg people to know us more, and no one can know us enough if we're honest, except this one guy who does know you, who gave up everything for you, who loves you more than you love yourself. And he knows the worst stuff about you. He knows your thoughts, your weird pride, lust, greed, anger. He knows the places you go. He goes, I get that. I see that. And it's not who you're going to be forever. But I know all of it, and I love you the same. There's no performing here. And I don't love John more than I love you. John likes to flex. He wrote John. So he's like the one Jesus loved. Love that. But at the end of the day, he loves Peter a lot. And so have you received that love? Because you have to receive it. It's not just true for all. You have to receive that love. But the number two big idea is we need to walk in the calling Jesus has given us. Your calling is the specific way God has called you to glorify him. So for Peter, it was to be an apostle. It was to help Christians endure persecution. It was to die a martyr's death. But here's the thing, Peter didn't need pity, he needed perspective. And that's exactly what Jesus was giving him. It was like, oh, this is a bummer calling. It was like, no, this is a calling that's going to change everything. And as you know about my resurrection, it doesn't end here. I believe knowing his calling and purpose put power into his life. It's one thing to suffer. It's another thing to suffer with purpose. I don't have time to get into it, but, you know, famous stories, research and stuff on the Holocaust, but those, many of those who made it out of the Holocaust believe that there was a purpose to their suffering. And in the same way, as God calls us into things, if we believe that there's a purpose to it, we can endure. Purposeless suffering is the worst thing in the world, but purposeful suffering is something you can even look back on with joy. So how would your perspective change if you knew that what you were doing each and every day, no matter how it turned out from a worldly standpoint, would still end in your joy in God's glory? And it's different for different people. God might call some of you to plant a church. He might call some of you to be a missionary. He might call some of you to be a faithful dad, a faithful mom in this season, in your place of work, faithful in generosity, whatever it is. Another big idea, your calling's bigger than your shame, guilt, or weakness. Your calling is bigger than your shame, guilt, or weakness. Peter would have assumed he was disqualified. He failed big with the big guy. Maybe you have, not maybe. You have sin in your past, but do you think your sin is too big? Maybe you have abuse or pain in your past. Maybe you're really aware of your limitations, whether they be education or experience or the type of family you came from, experiencing being marginalized, dysfunction, whatever it is. Jesus loves to take broken things and turn them into something beautiful that's useful. Jesus' work in the cross and resurrection gives us a fresh start and a new future. Our failure and our pain isn't final, even though it's real. Another idea is we need to remember that your calling exists. Remember that your calling isn't about you, that your calling exists for other people. Peter says, or Jesus says, feed my sheep. Your calling is not about finding something that makes you feel as fulfilled as possible. Often, you'll feel fulfilled if you do, but often it comes after you've stepped out in faith to do it. It's not in the doing it initially where you feel fulfillment. It's not about creating an identity for yourself. That's a lie that we often believe. A lot of millennials believe this lie that works about, you know, showing off who you are to the world as opposed to loving others. It's not just about making as much money as possible either. Very American idea. It exists for others. How do I uniquely love and bless people? Another thing we need to come back to is this idea that our calling is unique and personal. Our calling is unique and personal. So I've already hit hard. We shouldn't compare ourselves to others, wishing we had someone else's stuff. Now, what I have seen also, I've been a pastor for a long time. One pastor talks about this idea of, he calls them accidental Pharisees. And the idea is people try to project their calling onto other people and onto the church or onto whatever they're a part of, their business, their school. It's like, you should do what I'm really into because I'm really into it. You should be doing, like, if you're not a missionary, like I'm a missionary, you're a loser, right? If you're not into this specific issue of injustice, what are you even doing? Why are you even here, right? If you don't care about the things I care about. And rather than going, wait a minute, God put a unique calling and passion and level and experience in my heart. If I don't step into it, no one will. But again, if I'm spending all my time like judging other people for them not doing it, I'm really not doing it. And I'm annoying, right? You're controlling and you're like pushy and you're judgmental, right? When you think about, there's all kinds of different issues. You think about issues like racial injustice or abortion or caring for the poor or evangelism, right? Like if Billy Graham got really into, you know, helping the poor, that's not bad, but all those people don't get saved, right? And if Mother Teresa just got into just straight up evangelism, a lot of people who are poor aren't cared for. Right? We can only live one life. Does that make sense? We live in this world with like an infinite amount, what seems to be an infinite amount of data and information. We need to be up on everything. And the amount of time we spend trying to be up on everything, we could actually be making a difference in one area. Like a lot of us don't even bless our neighborhood and we're worried about like what's going on in Bangladesh. It's not bad to worry about Bangladesh. It's just, you'd probably make a bigger impact here, the place you actually are. We're worried about other people's families. What about your family? And if there's some leftover, you go and do that. Another core idea is your calling will look different in different seasons. Your calling will look different in different seasons. I believe that my calling is to help people break the chains of their past that they might walk into their calling of the future. something I'm passionate about. Like, what keeps you, what in your story keeps you from being the person God's called you to be? Now, that looks different with different people. But that's how I approach parenting. That's how I approach, if I worked in a business, that's how I would approach business. In ministry, I approach it that way. I think that way when I preach. This today is kind of on this, but I think about this all the time. Like, I think about when I pray for you as members of the church, I often think, like, what might God want to do through them? Like, what are they supposed to lead out there in the world? What businesses are they supposed to start? What families are they supposed to start? What on and on it goes. Like, who has God called them to be? What are they supposed to design or create? But here's the thing, that calling looks different in different seasons, right? We're all called to love God and love people, but again, where and how we do it, right? So for example, if you have brand new babies, your calling is going to look, it's going to be connected to that, or you're going to be doing less than maybe some other things. If you have aging parents, a new business or church plant or whatever it is, God may call you to do the same things over your life, but change up how you do them and what's emphasized. Again, we're all called to make disciples and for followers of Jesus. If you have kids that are still in your house, they should be your primary disciples. You don't need to worry about some random person at small group. You need to worry about them primarily. Like a question to ask is like, who are you called to love in this season, right? As Christians, who are we called to love? Just throw out answers. Who are we called to love? Huh? Neighbor. Okay, cool. What's a neighbor? Like your next door neighbor? Are you talking like the Bible's use of neighbor? Yeah. So neighbor, who else? Enemies. Okay. Anyone else? Everyone. Yeah. Everyone. So we're called to love everyone. Okay. So again, Sandra with the right answer in the back. So there's a free Dark Horse gift card for you on the way out, Sandra. Right. No, your answers weren't bad. They were true, but they weren't as true as they'd all fall under everything. But here's the thing: are we called to love everyone equally? No. We live in a time where we think we are supposed to love everyone equally. We're supposed to care about everything all the time. But here's the thing. If we're committed to everyone, we're committed to no one. Isn't that wild? In the book of Galatians chapter 6, verses 9 through 10, the Apostle Paul writes a church that had been really divided. And he says, "Let us not get tired of doing good, for we will reap at the proper time if we don't give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us work for the good of all, especially for those who belong to the household of faith." In other words, like, let's care for all people, but let's take care of the members of the church that we're committed to first. Okay? Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, Paul says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church." He's not saying husbands have multiple wives. He's saying you husbands the husband should love the wives. Husband, love your wife just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So sacrificially love her. Okay. So in other words, you should love your wife in a way that you don't love everyone else, right? I think we know that. There's some stuff that if you did with other people, it'd be real weird, real scandalous, real bad. Okay. But even if it wasn't scandalous, like if I, you know, great example. If my son Calvin had a basketball game and my friend Danny's son Jackson had a basketball game, he's like a nephew to me, and I don't go to Calvin's games to go to Jackson's games, that's weird. That's unhealthy, right? So again, it's not bad to go to the game, but I got to start here. There's concentric circles that God gives you relationships and spheres of influence that you need to worry about. And so that's taken care of. You don't need to worry about the next thing. Now, they don't care at all. But this should be the priority. This should be where the bulk of your time goes, is the people you actually know in your life that you're actually responsible for. You have limited time, financial resources, attention. You have one body. So again, where you live out your calling can't be everywhere all at once. No matter what planes and social media and phones make us think we can do, we can make a huge impact if we give ourselves to one place or just a couple places and a couple people over time. And so you start out, you know, my calling is to love these people. A part of it's who am I called to love? And it's these people. As we close, I'll call the worship band up. I think that a key to, and with Peter, it's interesting because he basically tells him right in that moment, here's your calling, here's where you're going. But what's similar to us is we compare in the same way. And actually, a lot of times it's catching what's ours. And I think for a lot of us, God's already put your calling in front of you. It's a big part. It's probably the job you already have, the family you already have. It's definitely that. Don't go start a new family. It's the family you already have. It's the kids you already have. It's the friends you already have. It's the church you already have. Spoiler alert, right? Like, love the place you are. Love the people who are with you in the unique ways that you're gifted to love them. Don't ask other people to do what you should be doing. Don't demand that they do it and be just like you. And at the same time, don't be jealous that they have something that they're called to do. In the words of Jesus, what does that have to do with you? You don't need to get involved in that way. But there's something tremendous for each one of you if you begin to step into it. There's goodness, and adventure and impact. Let's pray. Father, I pray right now that you, for those of us who have actually like walked in, not just comparison, but we've moved all the way to envy, where we've pushed people away, we've slandered people, we've judged them because they have what we want, and rather than being mature enough to just admit, oh, I'd love to have that and I don't have it, but I need to look to what I'm supposed to have, We've hurt them. We've moved away from them. Lord, I pray you'd convict us deeply, especially if it's within the life of the church. Lord, in addition to that, I pray for those who feel like they don't matter that much, or their calling isn't that important, or they go, like, what's the point of my days? I pray you would infuse their days with meaning and purpose and significance. There is no small task in the kingdom of God, and there are no small people. You can change a diaper as an act of worship and devotion, or you can just change a diaper. You can change a diaper as an act of love and service, or you can just change a diaper. You can turn in a spreadsheet report and just send it, or you can do it in such a way that it blesses and helps and makes sure that people get what they need. Can pray over it. God, life is full of surprises and adventures if we're aware of you in the midst of what we're doing. We can drive our elderly parents somewhere and just drive our elderly parents somewhere. We can see it as an act of love and an act of devotion to Jesus, to love someone as we've been loved. And on it goes. Would you infuse our daily lives with your sense of calling? Would you clarify the people? Some of us are trying to love too many people. This is a weird prayer to pray, Lord. I pray you would narrow our focus to love less people, but to love them well, the people that we're called to love clearly. That we throw ourselves into loving them and loving you, accepting our limitations with joy. I also pray, Lord, you'd give us the gift of contentment. It's the last thing I want to pray over this church, contentment. Ultimately, we have the bodies we have. You've given them to us. Ultimately, we more or less, you know, there's only so much any human, even in America in 2025, can really change a generational wealth situation. In so many ways, we have to surrender to what the life you've given us. We do the best we can with what we have, but at the end of the day, what you've given us, we can either constantly be disappointed that we're not some other place, or we can live with joy where we are as God takes us to some place. And so, Lord, would you just pour out the gift of contentment, and would that remove comparison and its kind of demonic cousin, envy? Could we celebrate those that we currently compare ourselves to? In Jesus' name, amen.